Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 22nd of July 1923, a white elephant in Singapore, a white elephant in Threadneedle Street, a war winner speaks, a war loser escapes, and a couple of libel cases. But first, the headlines. The docker strike is ongoing. The official trade union has lost control of the dockers, as indeed has the unofficial strike committee. In Germany, the nationalist terrorist Hermann Ehrhardt, who I briefly mentioned in the 27th of May episode, has escaped from prison. Ehrhardt was involved in a coup attempt in 1920 known as the Kapp Putsch, and the assassinations of the German signatory of the armistice, Matthias Erzberger, and the foreign minister, Walter Rathenau. It appears that in his escape bid, he received help from prison staff. And it looks like Turkey and the Allies have come to an agreement at Lausanne, and a new peace treaty will be signed. In other news, a few months ago, Mary Stopes, the birth control pioneer, lost a libel case. She had been accused of exposing the poor to experiment. I thought I'd mentioned it, but it appears that I hadn't. Anyway, she's appealed and won. The Oxford and Cambridge University Bill is being considered by Parliament. I cannot comment on its intent. This does not appear to be mentioned, but it has given rise to discussion over the status of women. From what I can work out, a not infrequent problem, they can study, they can take exams, but they cannot become graduates of the university. In the 1st of April episode, I mentioned that anti-Jewish conspiracy theorist Lord Alfred Douglas was suing the Morning Post, a newspaper that was eventually folded into the Daily Telegraph, for libel. The case even saw Winston Churchill give evidence owing to his previous position as political head of the Navy. Anyway, the jury has found in favour of Douglas and awarded him a farthing in damages. I suppose it's one way of saying that you think the whole case is spurious. On Monday the 16th of July, the House of Commons finished the debate on capitalism that I mentioned in the 25th of March episode. A part of the new Louvain Library has been inaugurated. The original was destroyed by Germany at the outset of the First World War, with the loss of hundreds of thousands of irreplaceable books and manuscripts. On Saturday the 21st of July came the news that in Mexico, Pancho Villa, the rebel, the general, the kingmaker, and one-time leader of an invasion of the United States, has been shot dead. And now for signs of the times. Last week I mentioned that interest rates had been raised from 3% to 4%. On Wednesday, a question was asked in Parliament about how much the government knew about this. The answer was nothing. In other words, the Bank of England was independent in much the same way as it is nowadays. There was a time when I was very much in favour of independent central banks. In the 1960s and 1970s, Britain had endless problems with inflation and a government-controlled central bank. Meanwhile, Germany had an independent central bank and very low inflation, and a successful economy. The Bank of England was made independent in 1997, and in 2008 we had the financial crisis, much of which I attribute to the actions of the bank. We would be better off without it. But who would issue the currency, I hear you ask? Other banks, as they used to. In a murder case reported on Saturday, the judge lamented the fact that the accused was allowed to take the stand. He argued that, until a quarter of a century earlier, that wasn't allowed on the basis that the evidence given by the accused, who would after all be on trial for his life, could not be relied upon. On Saturday, a trader was convicted of selling milk that had too low a fat content. It would appear that semi-skim milk was not yet a thing. On Wednesday the 18th came the news that Jacob Astor, owner of the Times and MP for Dover, had offered to build and for 2 years operate a hospital in Dover, so long as the local council was prepared to take over the running of it thereafter. I do find myself wondering if this represents philanthropy or bribery. There has been further discussion on plans for a naval base in Singapore. I'd long wondered why this was so significant, but I think I'm beginning to understand. It has been said that Britain was an Indian Ocean empire. The Indian Ocean was what the Mediterranean was to the Romans, our sea. And at this point in history, it didn't require much defence. India was British, Australia was British, large parts of East Africa were British. The only possible opponents were the French and the Dutch, and maybe the Papuans. But now in 1923, the Japanese have emerged as a possible rival, and they have battleships, which means Britain, which I think did not have battleships in the Indian Ocean, now has to have them. So where do you station them? Naval bases, as I understand it, need specialist facilities. You can't get by with any old port and any old dry dock. You have to build them. And now I'm beginning to understand why the loss of Singapore in 1942 was such a disaster. There was the loss of the base, there was the loss of the prestige, but there was also the inability to protect the empire. This was particularly felt in Australia, which was cut off from Britain, but not America. On Wednesday, a Geoffrey Drage wrote in support of the proposal. On Saturday, Admiral Percy Scott, scourge of the battleship, whom I mentioned in the 3rd of December episode, replied. Surely the main argument as regards the necessity of docks at Singapore large enough to take the battleships that we are now building of 35,000 tons each, and that is really the only question at issue, is if we are at war with Japan, how are our battleships going to get to Singapore, and what are they going to do when they get there? Well, I can answer that, Percy. They will sail via the Cape of Good Hope, and when they get there, they will be sunk. He goes on. Everyone ought to realise that our base at Singapore should be defended by submarines and aeroplanes, which would give any battleships from coming within 500 miles of the island, as the Germans kept our battleships from coming near the coast. Mr. Drage gives us some astonishing news about battleships. I think Mr. Scott is being a bit facetious here. He tells us that their existence has been threatened by new weapons, such as the torpedo, the mine, and aircraft, but that their construction has been developed so as to meet the threats of these weapons with success. This is just what has not been done and cannot be done. Our new battleships will be at the mercy of any one of the weapons Mr. Drage has mentioned. Let's think about this. The torpedo, yes, the Barham and the Royal Oak were both sunk by torpedo, as indeed was the aircraft carrier, the Ark Royal. As far as mines, I think they were a bit more lucky, although I'm pretty sure HMS Belfast hit a mine that was really very badly damaged, but that's only a mere cruiser. And then we come to aircraft. And, well, obviously the Prince of Wales and the Repulse were sunk by aircraft. Was anything else sunk by aircraft? I don't think so. I don't think so. He goes on. Mr. Drage tells us that Singapore has no modern defences. Surely the sooner that base is supplied with some modern weapons, the better. Mr. Drage considers it somewhat remarkable that Lord Grey, former Foreign Secretary, should consider that we should spend more money on our air forces in view of the danger to London, and that we should go slowly in developing Singapore. Surely Lord Grey is quite correct. The protection of London against aerial attack is of far more urgency than docks at Singapore. Well, you'd have to say, considering how things turned out, Admiral Scott here is quite correct. I also understand that one of the reasons that Singapore fell was that the British didn't have enough air cover or enough aircraft. Even the perceptive Admiral Scott has not considered the possibility that the attack on Singapore might come from land. On Tuesday the 17th, The Times reported Field Marshal Earl Haig's address to the British Empire Service League in London. He made some remarks about the First World War. See if you can spot any parallels with more recent conflicts. They had seen what unpreparedness for war had cost this generation. They had seen the sin of unpreparedness visited on their children, young lads, many of them scarcely more than boys, sacrificed to the neglect and lack of foresight which left us to face the World War with an army in numbers and artillery totally inadequate. He went on to talk about the desperate fighting at the First Battle of Ypres in late 1914. We had no reserves, and if we had fallen back a few miles, the Channel ports would have been lost. He had some 30 medium-heavy guns with his corps at that time, to withstand the punishment, as they know now, I have to say I wonder how, of 260 German heavy guns. We had practically no high explosive, and a great deficiency of artillery ammunition generally. Such was the state of affairs then, and the results of it were sadly apparent right down to the last days of the struggle. Some of the best brains of our youth, from Oxford and Cambridge, were employed on such duties as dispatch riding and carrying messages. Few survived. Public school battalions, sportsmen's battalions, and such like, absorbed in their ranks men who in civil life were leaders and should have been officers in war. Later we felt their loss, when during long years of war thousands of men died because they and the officers who led them had had insufficient time for training. The parallels with Ukraine are striking. Not ready for war? Check. Insufficient artillery? Check. Men with useful skills not being given a chance to use them? Check. Insufficient training? Check. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.